They tell you when you take, you criticize them for their munitions production, for opiates, for fossil fuels, for high drug prices. Well, we're just meeting market demand. Well, these 12 CEOs, they made profit, but they reversed the business model, focusing on protecting, treating workers' right, consumers' right, and environment. And they spoke out against war. They spoke out against Anita Roddick of Body Shop, spoke out against the cosmetic industry's harm on young customers. Ray Anderson changed
Ralph,
his entire...
We have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two, posted democracynow.org. Ralph Nader, author of The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Support for the KBOO Evening News comes from KBOO members and Lori Sonnenfeld Realty, helping people buy or sell a home or duplex in the greater Portland area for the past 35 years. More information at CascadiaHomes.com.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on KBOO Evening News, a new audit finds Oregon State Housing Agency doesn't know how many renters it helped during the pandemic.
The Cascade Range is expected to get multiple feet of snow this weekend, which is welcome news for skiers.
And in national news, a ban on gender-affirming care for minors in Idaho is blocked by a federal judge.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 5th, 2024. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Danny Shy. Oregon State Housing Agency doesn't know how many Oregonians were helped by pandemic rent relief. That's according to a scathing audit of Oregon Housing and Community Service. The state auditors acknowledge that the housing agency was put under unprecedented stress during COVID-19, but that they are still responsible for properly accounting for how public money is spent. One in seven Oregon workers lost their jobs in the spring of 2020, and demand for rent relief ballooned. The rental relief program ended over a year ago, and the agency still doesn't know how much of the nearly $500 million went to eligible Oregonians and how much was spent to people in error. Auditors estimate the state may have misspent around $11 million on landlords and renters who weren't eligible for who had committed fraud. Auditors made 16 recommendations for the housing agency to improve, and they've accepted half of them. The agency's budget has more than doubled in the past 6 years, and auditors emphasize that stress on the housing agency isn't likely to go away. Homelessness was declared an emergency in 2023, and a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake would mean major displacement for Oregon residents, among other things.
Heavy snow in the Cascades is expected to return this weekend after a rainy and warm December. For places like Timberline and Mount Hood Meadows, this could mean 1 to 2 feet of snow. The National Weather Service forecasts the snow level will drop to between 2,000 and 4,000 feet of elevation. So, drivers should expect to see snow on the mountain passes. The Weather Service's Andy Bryant told OPB, quote, "People who are driving up to ski areas or driving through passes like Highway 26 over Government Camp or Santa Ana Pass, you'll definitely want to monitor road conditions and be prepared for winter travel," end quote. Experts estimate that places below 2,000 feet will stay well above freezing and see steady rain through the weekend. Increasing the snowpack in the Cascades is a welcome sign, since December was so warm and rainy. As of yesterday, the snowpack in the Cascades was less than 40% of what it should be in early January. Low snowpack increases fire dangers in the summer and early fall, because trees and plants dry out much more quickly, becoming fuel for a potential fire. But forecasters say there's still time for the snowpack levels to recover to more average levels by the end of March.
An Oregon Court of Appeals has temporarily blocked the Multnomah County-flavored tobacco ban. KBOO's Ezra has more on the story.
On December 28th of 2023, an Oregon Court of Appeals blocked the Multnomah County-flavored tobacco ban. This ban prohibits sale of flavored nicotine products within Multnomah County and applies to all licensed tobacco retailers within the county. Unless further legal challenge blocks it, later in 2024, retailers can expect to be penalized unless they remove flavored tobacco and nicotine products from their shelves. The county planned to conduct inspections to ensure that the ban's qualifications are being met if it is implemented and issue penalties to shops not in compliance. Earlier last year, a judge dismissed a case against the county, ruling in favor of the ban. It passed in December of 2022, and its target start date was January 1st of 2024. Marcus Nettles of Rose City Vapors told K2 News, quote, "It was going to be a trip. Like, I'd have zero nicotine devices available, but those aren't a popular seller, so it was going to take some strategy to even be able to stay in business." The ban is now on hold, with local vape and tobacco shops able to keep flavored nicotine products on their shelves for a while longer. For KBOO News, I'm Ezra.
3 years after January 6th, democracy remains under a cloud. A court finding of gerrymandering sends Michigan districts to a now reconstituted commission. And a transgender woman is disqualified from running for the Ohio House. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It's honestly inspiring to me that they pulled off 2020 as they did, that they gave voice to more voters than we had ever seen in any election in American history. And then when their work was challenged dozens of times in court, it held up every single time.
David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation says in spite of everything, local election officials deliver for American democracy. A wave of bomb threats have disrupted business at a dozen state capitals just days before the third anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. But Becker says the folks actually running elections are inspirational. A federal court is expected to clarify issues over Detroit election maps today after a three-judge panel struck down 13 Michigan House and Senate districts for racial gerrymandering. Meanwhile, the maps go back before bipartisan redistricting commission. Sarah Reinhart with the Michigan Department of State says three new members should help that body meet the enthusiastic hopes of state citizens.
In November of 2018, Michigan voters overwhelmingly passed a constitutional amendment establishing our state's first ever citizen-led redistricting commission. By June of 2020, more than 9,300 Michiganders had applied to serve.
Former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley is pushing back against former President Donald Trump's attack that she raised taxes when governor of South Carolina. Haley says it's a distortion. She calls the Trump's campaign attack ads a temper tantrum to distract his record deficits.
Everybody talks about how good the economy was under Trump, and it was good, right? But at what cost? He put us $8 trillion in debt just in 4 years. Our kids will never forgive us for that.
In a new video, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie says Trump is willing to sell the soul of this country. According to Christie, simply being ahead in the polls shouldn't be reason enough for any Republican candidate to blindly support the former president.
8 years ago, when I decided to endorse Donald Trump for president, I did it because he was winning. And I did it because I thought I could make him a better candidate and a better president. Well, I was wrong. I made a mistake.
Haley and Christie's attacks on Trump come just 10 days before the Iowa caucuses. They also mark a sharp shift in tone, with Trump's rival shying away from direct criticism for fear of alienating a Republican base still strongly tied to the former president. Vanessa Joy, a Democrat and a transgender woman, is now disqualified from an Ohio House of Representatives race due to her failure to disclose her former name in filing paperwork.
I would have had to have my dead name on my petitions. In the trans community, our dead names are dead. There's a reason it's dead. That is a dead person.
Ohio Republican Governor Mike DeWine caught flack in the party for just vetoing a bill banning transgender care. Joy's estranged stepfather, Republican Ohio State Representative Bill Romer, supported the vetoed legislation. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The job market will increasingly be dominated by positions that require education greater than a high school degree. An analysis finds 72% of jobs will require post-secondary education or training by 2031. In Oregon, 70%, or nearly 1.5 million jobs, will require some post-secondary training beyond high school in 2031. Danielle Smith reports from Arkansas.
In Arkansas and across the country, getting a college degree will become increasingly important in the job market of the future. A report from Georgetown University says almost 3 in 4 jobs will require higher education or training beyond high school by 2031. Arkansas ranks last among states for its share of jobs requiring post-secondary education. Report co-author Nicole Smith at Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce also predicts the U.S. will have 171 million jobs by 2031, or 16 million more than a decade earlier. She shares some of the industries that will need workers with degrees.
But what we found in this report is that there's a growing number of healthcare support jobs, a growing number of sales jobs, food and personal services jobs, and even blue-collar jobs that require more and more post-secondary education and training.
The report reveals on average 157,000 job openings will be available annually in Arkansas, and 94,000 of them will be for workers with post-secondary credentials. Smith contends the window is closing for workers who only have a high school diploma, and opportunities would need to be available for them to pursue further education.
Those that don't have the key to the future, and that key is a post-secondary vocational certificate, certification, a test-based license, some type of credential beyond high school. If you don't have that key, you run the risk of being left behind. So it's important to create safety nets.
She also voiced concern that the U.S. isn't producing enough skilled workers to meet the future demands. The research shows only 60% of high school graduates go on to college right after high school, and only 60% of them graduate from college, which isn't sufficient to replace retiring workers. I'm Danielle Smith, Arkansas News Service. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
Just before New Year's, a federal judge temporarily blocked a ban on gender-affirming care for trans minors in Idaho. KBOO's Ezra has more on the story.
The Idaho ban on trans health care for gender-diverse youth would mean any doctor who provides gender-affirming care to someone under 18 within the state risks fines of up to $5,000 and a felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. A federal judge blocked it, citing violation of the 14th Amendment 6 days before it was to go into effect on January 1st of 2024. Gender-affirming care exists to allow transgender people of any age to realign their perceived gender with the way they know themselves internally. It uses methods such as hormone therapy and surgery, and in many trans teens' cases, puberty blockers. These medications are used to help minimize the trauma of going through a transformation that feels wrong to them and to allow them to move through the world in ways that feel right. Gender-affirming care is highly individualized and an evidence-based practice. It's supported as medically necessary by multiple medical associations in the United States, including the American Academy of Pediatrics. The Idaho ban on affirming care, known as the Vulnerable Child Protection Act, isn't the first of its kind, but it is one of the first victories for trans people against legislative repression. An estimated 3 in 10 trans minors lives with legislative bans on their health care as of November 2023. Leo Morales of the American Civil Liberties Union of Idaho stated, quote, "This judicial decision is a much-needed ray of hope for trans people amid a years-long onslaught against their rights to access health care and ability to navigate the world around them," end quote. The block will hold until the case moves through the legal system, with the state requesting a ruling by January 17th. For KBOO News, I'm Ezra.
The pharmaceutical industry has faced heavy scrutiny over the cost of insulin medication, but with federal and state policies designed to cap out-of-pocket expenses continuing to take shape, drug makers themselves are slashing prices. That has consumer advocates hopeful. Mike Moan has more details in North Dakota.
This week, the movement to cap insulin prices for diabetes patients grew larger in the U.S. Consumer advocates in North Dakota say the news is welcome as state and federal policies evolve to limit skyrocketing costs for the drug. On January 1st, Sanofi became the latest manufacturer to implement insulin price cuts, capping out-of-pocket expenses at $35 a month. That mirrors a federal change adopted in 2022 for Medicare enrollees. Josh Askvig with AARP North Dakota says mounting pressure from grassroots efforts is sparking change.
It's clear that consumers have said enough, and there's been work on the advocacy front, including here in North Dakota, to say we're not going to do this anymore.
AARP was one of several groups to push for a recent change in North Dakota law that caps insulin prices for state workers. For its part, Sanofi says the voluntary step to reduce costs adds to other low-price approaches that have been weighed down by structural issues in the healthcare system. However, analysts say manufacturers face growing competition from nonprofit ventures and other states pursuing their own insulin production. Other federal policies kick in this year, requiring drug companies to pay a rebate to the government if their prices rise faster than inflation. As for the outlook in North Dakota, Askvig says more needs to be done.
We now know Medicare is going to start negotiating prices, so is there an opportunity to reference Medicare negotiated prices for state pricing in North Dakota?
He says that's one of several possibilities to explore when the North Dakota legislature reconvenes in early 2025. When it comes to the insulin cost burden, Kaiser Family Foundation reported in 2022 that 1 in 20 customers, whose costs exceed private insurance caps, paid more than $150 per month to access the medication. Some drug companies have defended higher prices, saying they're the result of research and advances in technology. This is Mike Mullen for Prairie News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, LTAR, or Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with some rain showers and an overnight low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 46. Today in history, in 2005, the dwarf planet Eris is discovered by astronomers, later motivating the International Astronomical Union to define the term planet for the first time. The quote of the day is from Italian philosopher and writer Umberto Eco, who was born this day in 1932. He said, and said, and said, "The real hero is always a hero by mistake. He dreams of being an honest coward like everybody else. If it had been possible, he would have settled the matter otherwise and without bloodshed. He doesn't boast of his own death or of others, but he does not repent. He suffers and keeps his mouth shut. If anything, others then exploit him, making him a myth, while he, the man worthy of esteem, was only a poor creature who reacted with dignity and courage in an event bigger than he was."
Advocates for Missing and Murdered Indigenous People, or MMIP, say in order to address the violence, communities need to break the silence and build more support systems. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. Advocates and tribal leaders working to address violence in Alaska Native communities say support systems and lifting taboos are needed in order to help people heal. Leanne Gubatayo is a survivor of domestic violence. She says she found a safe place and support when her parents brought her home to Juneau.
As I learned about trying to recognize that domestic violence was a part of my family and try to heal that, I was able to do that in my homeland with my parents and with a women's shelter that really helped teach me.
Gubatayo talks openly about her journey to help others, saying it's not something to ignore or hide.
Speaking our truth, telling our stories, but to have the community really acknowledge that our women have suffered and that they need all of us to gather and to heal, right? Because what we want to do is we want to break the silence, to break the cycle, so that the next generations don't have this same level of trauma that we have. But we want to teach them how to have healthy coping skills, how to reach out to people and get the support that you need.
It may be hard for Alaska Native communities to confront some of these tough issues, but Tlingit and Haida President Chahlaish Richard Peterson says it's needed.
When you talk about domestic violence, when you talk about murder to missing Indigenous women and people, that through line of trauma is there. And it's hard to have to admit some of these things. It's hard to have these conversations.
Peterson says he's working to make sure people have the support they need for a successful journey.
When we talk about healing, I'm going to stand up and say these things. I'm going to stand up and say the things that scare me. It's really hard to pull these things out of the dark and put them in the light. But I'm going to hold myself accountable, and I'm going to hold others accountable. You know, healing's a journey. And it's like any journey, it's usually better walked with others.
This story's a partnership with FNX Television with support by the Public Welfare Foundation. The Common Council in Kenosha, Wisconsin, okayed an agreement with the Menominee Nation, helping the tribe with its goal of building a casino and entertainment complex in the city. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM reports.
Common Council members voted 11-6 in favor of the intergovernmental agreement. Alderperson Daniel Prozanski, Jr. says the millions of dollars per year in gaming revenue that the Menominee would eventually pay the city of Kenosha would help fund things local residents want.
Better police presence. And we do want a safety building, or we do want access to better advanced medical EMS. And this is a way to help offset some of those costs.
Opponents question the Menominee's plan to partner with Hard Rock International, owned by the Seminole Tribe of Florida, to also have a hotel, music venue, and restaurants at the casino site. There was concern about Hard Rock maybe pulling out of the project. But Joey Awanape, who chairs the Menominee Kenosha Gaming Authority, says Hard Rock remains very committed to the relationship.
We took a trip down to the Seminole Tribe a year ago, and we re-strengthened that commitment with the Seminole Tribe and with Hard Rock International.
If the Kenosha County Board okays the Menominee's plan this month, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers and the Interior Department would still have to approve. I'm Chuck Kornbach.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Air pollution is a real issue in major cities, and incentivizing residents and visitors to cut the use of cars can be a challenge. New York City has a plan to combat automobile emissions, but it's not without controversy. The so-called congestion pricing toll plan is under fire for the impacts it's expected to have in terms of the environment and prices for other services. Edwin J. Vieira has the details.
New York City's congestion pricing plan is set to start later this year despite widespread opposition. The plan calls for drivers entering Manhattan's Central Business District, defined as all streets below 60th, to pay a toll. Proponents argue it will boost public transportation use and cut air pollution, but lawmakers and community activists disagree. Michelle Birnbaum with the Coalition in Opposition to Congestion Pricing predicts this plan will merely transfer Manhattan's traffic problems to other areas and also increase air pollution.
The traffic will increase in the areas outside the zone, causing noise, pollution, and congestion in those areas. They'll be cruising with vehicles and for hire vehicles to go into the zone. They'll be cruising for parking spots.
One assessment shows air pollution will increase in the Bronx, Staten Island, and into New Jersey. The city of Fort Lee and state of New Jersey have filed lawsuits about the program's effects. Most recently, the United Federation of Teachers president and Staten Island's borough president filed a lawsuit citing the environmental impacts. The MTA is holding several public comment sessions starting on February 29th. The only roads exempt from the program are the Battery Park Underpass, the West Side Highway, and FDR Drive. Bus companies have been wondering if they'll get an exemption from the tax, and Birnbaum wonders how the program will have a future if it's successful.
They want to eliminate cars and trucks coming into the zone, but if they eliminate it enough, they don't get their target money.
But a study from New Jersey Democratic Representative Josh Gottheimer finds MTA stands to make around $3.4 billion annually from the program, well over MTA's estimate of $1 billion. Public feedback has been mixed, with some noting it will force the MTA to make improvements to mass transit. Given this uncertainty, Birnbaum thinks the congestion pricing introduction should have been handled differently.
Our mayor is sort of buckling on this a little bit. If they felt so strongly about it, put it up for a vote. Instead, somebody introduced it into the budget.
A Siena College Newsday poll finds more than 70% of Long Islanders are opposed to congestion pricing. Nassau County's government set up a petition for people to sign opposing congestion pricing too. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in February about whether or not to freeze a plan created by the Environmental Protection Agency to regulate ozone levels in the U.S. At issue is the case, in this case, is the, quote, good neighbor provision for the Clean Air Act. Under the Clean Air Act, the EPA sets national air quality standards for ozone and other air pollutants. These pollutants can trigger asthma and make other respiratory conditions like bronchitis and emphysema worse. The good neighbor provision requires upwind states to limit air emissions that would cause downwind states to default on those federal standards. Various states have challenged the regulations. In this case, Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, and various energy companies, including U.S. Steel Corp. and Kinder Morgan, challenged the plan in D.C. Circuit Court. They say the rule is unreasonable and arbitrary, and asked for an immediate freeze while litigation continues in federal appeals court. The EPA argues that putting the plan on hold would delay efforts to control unhealthy pollution in downwind states, and that the challenging states hadn't demonstrated any permanent harm. In an important ruling last June, the conservative majority Supreme Court imposed limits on EPA's authority to regulate carbon emissions reductions from coal and gas-fired power plants. President Biden said of the ruling at the time, quote, another devastating decision that aims to take our country backwards, end quote.
Studies show more than half of the U.S. Latino population resides in states with the highest levels of climate change threats, such as air pollution, extreme heat, and flooding. At the same time, Latinos are on track to become 30% of the nation's population by 2050. A new report outlines how climate change is challenging Latinos' health, safety, food security, livelihood, and cultural legacy. Roz Brown reports.
As climate change makes extreme weather events more common globally, Latinos often face the most significant impacts to their health, safety, food security, and livelihoods. A new report from the Hispanic Access Foundation details those impacts and how climate change erodes cultural legacy when neighborhoods undergo gentrification, displacing traditional communities. Conservation Program Manager Vanessa Munoz says Latinos in every state are experiencing challenges to their mental health and identity due to climate change.
Some places might suffer severe temperatures and others might be more exposed to flooding or to a lot of wildfires, which is often where a lot of the Latino communities reside.
In New Mexico, she says drought and higher temperatures threaten Latinos, while in other states they're displaced by rising sea levels. 71% of Latino adults said climate change already impacts their local community. To promote what she calls a just transition towards a climate-friendly economy for all people, Munoz says the report includes a toolkit and policy recommendations to help communities better preserve Latino heritage.
One of the ways it's joining groups and forces to really protect our lands and prevent that from expanding, to prevent further loss and damage, which is necessary in these times of climate change.
Latinos are projected to make up 30% of the U.S. population by 2050, and over half reside in states with the highest levels of climate change threats. The Hispanic Access Foundation released its Cultural Erosion, the Climate Threat to Latino Heritage report at the recent COP28 conference in Dubai. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
In upstate New York, farmers grow plants year-round in a geothermal greenhouse. The system needs only a little energy to run. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, Terry Bloom, the owner of Stone Bend Farm in Newfield, New York, built a greenhouse. He's using it for more than growing plants. The 4,000-square-foot timber-framed structure houses a farm-to-table kitchen and taproom, too, and it's all heated by geothermal energy.
You say geothermal and people's eyes glaze over a lot of times because it sounds so technical and scientific, but it's so simple, and that's what I love about it.
Just a little ways underground, the Earth maintains a fairly stable temperature. In New York State, it's about 50 to 55 degrees year-round. Geothermal systems harness that warmth to provide heating when it's cold out. Under Bloom's greenhouse, thousands of feet of plastic drainage pipes snake back and forth. Fans pull the air through the pipes and into the building.
Let's say it's 0 degrees outside. When you feel that air come out of the vents, the geothermal vents, it's going to feel like heating.
The system requires only a little energy to run, and it helps Bloom avoid using more expensive and polluting sources of heat like natural gas or propane. During the winter, the greenhouse does get cool, but the plants stay alive and hardy customers gather to enjoy local food and beer in a one-of-a-kind setting. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 5th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Chris Gao and Ezra. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Roz Brown, Edwin J. Vieira, Daniel Smith, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.